This week's DataNauts podcast is sponsored in part by Interop ITX, the only independent conference for technology leaders. Get a year's worth of objective IT education in 1 week. Visit interopitx.com and use promo code PacketPushers for a 20% discount. Back when I was a relative IT noob, Microsoft was taking over the planet. At the time, Windows was really the only serious desktop OS around, and that was at a time when client-server was redefining computing, so the Microsoft Office suite was displacing every other Office suite, and then NT Server was shoving Novell out of the door with every refresh cycle. And if you add to that the Microsoft Back Office suite that was a thing you could buy at the time, all of a sudden Microsoft was everywhere and you paid for all of it. Microsoft was making bank. Linux, then, they were the resistance, and you had witty penguin t-shirts that were saying things like, in a world without Windows, who needs Gates? And open source desktops and servers began to be on the rise. And now 20 years later, Microsoft has decided that if they can't beat them, they might as well join them. On the DataNauts podcast today, open source Microsoft. We'll review the many different ways Microsoft is involved with open source and why you should care. At PacketPushers.net, you can find this and all of our DataNauts shows about infrastructure engineering, or just search for DataNauts, spelled like astronauts, in your favorite podcatcher. You can follow us at DataNauts_show. I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks, and with me is the fabulous Chris Wall at Chris Wall, and he is currently planning a trip to Mars to find out what all the fuss is about. Joining us today is our very special guest, Melissa Wright. She is VCDX number 236, and she is the Virtual Design Master Creative Director. Melissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
I remember the very first Virtual Design Master that came out, I was asked to be a judge, and it was a blast. And there was like zombies eating the data center, and you had to defend from it. That was all you, right, Melissa?
Yeah, that was zombies eat my data center. That was my brainchild.
We'll talk about what the Virtual Design Master thing is all about.
Okay, so what Virtual Design Master is, besides the fact that there's zombies everywhere, it's sort of a community-based architecture challenge. I think we're going into our fifth season this summer. So every year, we get a group of people who are looking to learn, grow, and challenge themselves in new ways. We come out with different infrastructure architecture-based challenges. We test architecture skills, security, hands-on, basically everything under the sun. They're competing for a great prize pool. We've had Chris judge. We've had several other VCDXs judge. We've had great prizes, cash prizes, VCDX, mentorship packages. We've kind of had it all. We've had a lot of great community support behind it.
So it's not an official like certification. It's just something that you can engage in as someone who wants to be really good at their job in the world of infrastructure and virtualization and test your knowledge and your skills against this hypothetical problem.
Exactly. And it's more than that. You know, let's say someone doesn't have the skill set, but they know they want to learn more about architecture. This is a great place to get your feet wet and start developing those skills. Because, you know, that's not something you necessarily have a chance to get exposure to every day. So we've had people with no architecture experience whatsoever come on and start learning the process.
Yeah, and I remember the winner of season one, Akmal, actually, it helped him with his career as well. He's like, hey, I'm a design master. He could showcase that. And I think he got a job that he was looking to do because of the program, which to me, that's the part to really applaud. You're helping people with their career and giving a helping hand or like a good push in the right direction, because architecture is not something you really learn in school for a lot of cases. It's a lot of experience, and something that's kind of hidden behind the curtain a lot of cases is a pretty cool thing. So I really applaud the effort that y'all do over there at Virtual Design Master.
Thank you. I went through the VCDX process, and Virtual Design Master helped me a lot because, A, I was writing the challenges. So beyond the, you know, here's your requirements, constraints, risks, assumptions, blah, 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 all that good stuff. What we would do is we'd give crazy scenarios with everything, too. So I'd be like, hey, the zombies ate your infrastructure and you have five-year-old hardware. Go design something, stuff like that. So we kind of have this recurring zombie storyline in the process as well. And Byron Schaller was also a contestant one season on Virtual Design Master, and he also went and got his VCDX. So that's really exciting. We have a lot of people, they give us this feedback. It's been great for their career. It's been great for knowledge. And we have people, you know, going all the way up the chain and getting their VCDX or other master level certifications.
So give me a URL. Where can people go if they want to know more about Virtual Design Master?
VirtualDesignMaster.io.
Perfect. VirtualDesignMaster.io. And we're going to have that in the show notes at PacketPushers.net. And now, Melissa, let's progress to the main attraction for today's show, which is Microsoft and open source. And we're going to hit three things today: Microsoft and their partnership with Docker that was recently announced, open source PowerShell. We may mention some of their open source hardware initiatives, and then the fact that Microsoft has joined the Linux Foundation. So first up, Microsoft and the Docker partnership. First of all, Chris, maybe I don't know how much homework you've done on this. As you look at that partnership and what was announced, does this mean I can now do things for free within the Microsoft world that have to do with containers? Is it that sort of a partnership, or what was really announced here?
Take a step back. It's really about the idea that Microsoft has always put on that Ballmer cheerleader, developers, developers, you know, with the pit stains and everything. And they're missing the boat on this, because Docker is a great platform or a way that you can start containerizing binaries, essentially workloads. And they're like, wow, this really sucks. We're missing out on this. What can we do? Now, there's no free lunch with Microsoft. You still have to buy licensing for the desktop environment or MSDN or the server. But it's really about, hey, let's take the commercially supported or CS Docker engine, make it available directly within the Server 2016 release. They're not charging for that, but really it's kind of giving you the keys to the guy that's selling the Coke. You know, it's like, oh, well, if we put Docker into our platform, make it kind of native, make it easy, then we're going to get a lot of people that are using this particular platform. Or maybe just they won't leave because they're already on the platform and they're not going to migrate elsewhere. Although most people that I know that are developers are either more in the PowerShell.net, Silverlight world. They're just pure Windows people or pure Microsoft people. Or they're completely outside of it. They're running it in CentOS or Ubuntu or whatever it is that they like as a flavor of Linux. And they don't give a rat's tail about running Docker on Windows.
Yeah, my take was it really looks more like a commercial venture. Several different parts. You've got the commercially supported Docker engine running on a very limited number of Windows platforms, specifically Windows Server 2016. You'll be able to add that Docker engine to Windows Server 2016, no additional cost there. Docker engine will run on Windows 10 with the anniversary update. I'm not sure why I'd want to do that necessarily. Maybe licensing, perhaps. Microsoft's going to give you enterprise support for the commercially supported Docker engine. Microsoft and Docker are going to promote Docker Data Center. Docker Data Center being really the automated suite is kind of how I look at it, to bring containerization to your enterprise in a commercially supported way. You can do things like Visual Studio tools for Docker are going to integrate with Docker for Windows, going back to Ballmer and his pit stains. So yeah, devs can Dockerize Windows apps more easily. And maybe that's a big thing, because if you're thinking, oh, I can now use Windows as my platform to run all these containers I've already built that run in my Docker Linux environment. Well, no, this is for Windows apps running on Windows, not Linux apps running on Windows. That's not how that works. That's not how containers work. So it's not that sort of a thing. And Microsoft started to containerize some of their apps. There's base images, if you go into Docker Hub, that you can find Windows container items that are out there, including things like Microsoft SQL Server. And oh, they're so lightweight.
Oh, that's funny you mentioned that, because I think that one of the reasons that Linux started doing so well in the enterprise was, you know, 10 years ago, virtualization was expensive. The storage space on the SAN was expensive. The memory, the CPU, everything was just so expensive. And we saw people looking at Linux as, hey, this Linux server is much more lightweight. Maybe I should be doing that because I could do more with the resources than I have today. So I think that's maybe why we saw a big shift in that direction. I know I saw it in some of the organizations I was a part of. And now with Microsoft trying to bring that same agility back to the Windows platform, is it lightweight or not? I would go with a Windows container is probably more lightweight than a complete Windows install. It's definitely more agile. You definitely don't need to worry about your whole Windows install as much as you did before. So we're taking that agility and portability of the Docker containers and bringing it to the Windows platforms.
I was sitting in Silicon Valley talking to Docker as part of a Tech Field Day delegation, and I raised this question because they were announcing this Docker on Windows. And I said, who wants this? Why? It's about the tooling and it's about the process. The ability to deploy a container on Linux has led to a number of process improvements as you're deploying applications on your infrastructure. And let's bring that same sort of process to the Windows platform now. And no, I don't think Windows apps are, by comparison, as lightweight as Linux containers. Windows containers seem to be a bit heavier on the whole right now. Maybe that gets better over time as this all improves, but it's step one in moving down the road.
It's also important to point out that this allows you to start consuming more of the resources in Azure, because the resource manager templates are available with the Docker VM extension, so that you can build, I guess, on-prem or in their cloud offering, including they're going to have the Azure Stack for kind of on-prem cloudy type environments. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of competition, I think, in the AWS market and potentially GCE and others. This allows you to just stick that Kool-Aid of Docker right into your veins and inject Azure and whatever it is you want into the mix. And again, it just all kind of goes back to developers and people trying to build some type of service or offering using everything that Microsoft has under the sun.
Is this really Microsoft moving into the open source world? I mean, it seemed logical to have the conversation here, although the more you look at this offering and the partnership between Microsoft and Docker, the more it feels like a commercial offering, really, which as you analyze Docker, that's an important thing to understand, is that they have open source components of Docker, and then they have commercial components of Docker. So is this Microsoft moving more towards open source, or is this really Microsoft and Docker trying to figure out dollars?
I think you have something there. And I think it's about Microsoft moving into the current day. They're seeing what Linux is doing and how it's been wildly successful with things like Docker. And they're saying, maybe we should start offering this to our customers as well, so they don't go over to the other side. Plus, there's something to be said for the commercially supported version. There's a ton of organizations that are completely Windows-based, and there's a ton of applications out there that are Windows-only and are mission-critical. This is a way of bringing all that into this century. I know that sounds horrible, right?
You old crusty tech guys, get to the
you
Docker
world. You old tech people, embrace DevOps.
Well, it's also one of the things I enjoy as a MVP is meeting people in the product groups and the actual guys and gals that are writing the code. I don't know how much this has an effect on the strategic and kind of thought leadership that exists at the top of Microsoft, but everyone I talked to is really excited about this stuff. All the techs and the engineers and the nerds working at Microsoft are like, yeah, this is cool. You know, you've got Jeffrey Snover kind of tooting his horn, wearing his funky tie, saying open source and Docker and Linux and what they can do with those platforms, because if you just sit to one particular slice of the data center, that's your world. And this mm-hmm. allows them to operate across all the different slices of the data center. And as technologists, they're really excited about that. So it helps energize the team. It's easier to recruit people. They actually established MVP, which is their Microsoft Most Valuable Professional program, for people that are into automation. Linux has an MVP program now. There's all sorts of new ways to get in. And it just stirs the pot a little bit of excitement so they can onboard talent and keep talent in the house.
Microsoft is a significant portion of the enterprise market as well. I mean, we talk on this show a lot, Linux, 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 and it's almost presumed that Linux is the back-end operating system that's hosting these apps. But
maybe you do. I don't.
Yes, you're a bigger Microsoft fan than me. Okay, that's fair. But I think in the context of a lot of what gets talked about in media, you would overlook Microsoft pretty easily a lot of times, especially in the emerging tech world. So to see Docker show up on Microsoft's doorstep and vice versa makes a lot of sense, because there is a really big market there. And one of you guys just put it, the crusty old, come on, get with the program. Now they've got this opportunity to do that using Docker, a very recognized name in this space. So it seems to make sense for everyone that's involved. I also thought it was interesting that Microsoft committed to putting containers out in the Docker Hub, containerized versions of some of their apps. Now you can download SQL Server. I've all but actually done this. I've got a server sitting on a virtual machine. I haven't actually taken the step to do it yet, but you can download Microsoft SQL Server, and you can use it for, I want to say, 30 days before you then have to license it up. So it's another interesting way for Microsoft to say, hey, kick the tires, try our technology. You don't have to go and download an ISO and install it on it. You don't have to be all complicated like that. Do it the Docker way.
So could I just set up a new container every 30 days?
Yeah. I don't know what the gotcha is there, you know, how strongly they're enforcing their licensing scheme. But yeah, in theory, you could just, you know, keep rotating every 30 days. So for the home users, that's maybe a different problem to solve than for the enterprise.
But that's just going back to the old playbook, man. I mean, that's in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, et cetera. That was called put Microsoft stuff in the schools. Get them hooked early. Get them hooked often, early and often, so that you're using this stuff. You go out into the workforce. You're like, yeah, I want my office and I want my whatever. Give all this stuff away. Get people on it. They start the drip and then they can't get off.
So basically they're drug dealers.
Yeah.
I do not mind thinking of Docker as a drug because it's pretty amazing.
That's a methodology that works, though, right? That's been proven over time.
It does, absolutely.
So it's hard to criticize Microsoft and Docker for going down the road that way.
I think it's really good to help people get started with it, because if I can try it for free for 30 days, that's enough time for me to maybe do a little POC in my environment and see if this is something I should even investigate, see if we're ready for it.
Another observation here, there's nothing stopping Microsoft's mighty engineering team from building a container strategy of their own. Yeah, Docker's good for the Linux world, but we're going to build our own container strategy and it's going to look like X, whatever. Kind of like they built Hyper-V on the virtualization side of things. Why not build their own container strategy? They didn't. And you guys correct me if I'm wrong. I haven't heard anything where they're planning on doing that. They just kind of said, screw it, we're joining Docker and going down that road.
Pretty much. And, you know, I think a big part of that is just Docker has evolved so rapidly. It has so much support behind it. There's so much buzz around it. Now, every time you have a Docker conversation, you can bring Microsoft Windows into it. Had they gone build their own, what would the adoption have even been like? Now you could have a Docker person on Linux. The old crusty IT guy says, hey, you know, we really need to get this working on our Windows platform as well. You can do that in this case.
As we pause the Datanauts infrastructure rocket for just a moment, let's talk about the conference the Packet Pushers are going to be at in May 2017, Interop ITX, and they are a sponsor of today's show. Interop ITX is where tech pros go to get objective, full-stack IT education, and it takes place May 15th through 19th at the MGM in Las Vegas. You can join me, Ethan Banks, along with Greg Farrow and Drew Conry Murray of the Packet Pushers, where we will be putting on the Future of Networking Summit, and that is a two-day session where we're going to take a deep dive into next-generation developments in the WAN, data center networking, network operations, software-defined security, all the things that we think are emerging over the next 1, 5, and 10 years. Register for Interop ITX and attend other hands-on workshops like The Future of Data, Container Crash Course, Dark Reading's Cybersecurity Summit, and the Open Source IT Summit. The event's conference tracks focus on security, DevOps, cloud, infrastructure, data and analytics, all the technologies you need for a successful full-stack IT strategy. If you're looking to accelerate your career, there's also plenty of sessions on leadership and professional development. Plus, check out over 100 vendors at Interop ITX's Business Hall, where you'll have the opportunity to check out what leading and emerging tech vendors have to offer. Join us at Interop ITX this coming May and use promo code PacketPushers when you register, and you'll receive a 20% discount. We want to see you in Vegas, so go on up to interopitx.com and reserve your spot today.
Okay, Docker, Docker, Docker. I can see the little badgers popping up all over the place due to the fun little meme. Let's move to something way entirely more interesting. PowerShell, it's open source. That came out reasonably recently. And I think back in July or so, I got an early preview of a dev build they were doing, which was saying, hey, PowerShell is great. Everyone in the Windows world loves it. And that's kind of true. It's an amazing framework for scripting and writing code. But there's kind of like there's Mac people and Linux people, and they can't use it. So they open sourced it. They put it on GitHub of all places. They're closing issues and taking pull requests. And now you can run, I think it's still in the alpha stage, PowerShell on Linux and Mac OS using the PowerShell core. Thoughts and opinions there. Is everyone excited as I am?
I'm excited.
So one thought here, it's released as alpha. So, I mean, is it that course? Have you actually tried PowerShell on either Linux or Mac OS, Chris?
Yeah. So it's alpha for a couple reasons, and these are my opinions for the most part. Well, let me back up a little bit. When this came out, I tweeted some stuff saying, hey, here's how you get it running on Mac and Linux. The Linux people, more likely the Unix people, were so angry at me. Like, I don't want that on my machine. That's a virus. It's horrible. I was like, well, you could just not install it. It's not like it comes native with your operating system. So there was just a lot of like bile and hatred. So that's kind of a thing to overcome as a cultural political thing. But more technical, there were some collisions with standard Nix commands that we use as aliases in PowerShell. We didn't want to conflict with those, the Linux and Mac world. So they're kind of having to resolve, what does this need to look like? And that's why it's kind of alpha, because it's still very moldable. It's still kind of like Play-Doh. And plus, most of the administrators that have been taught PowerShell over the last like decade or so are now able to potentially use aliases that would live in Linux or Mac OS. So how do we write that? because those aliases don't exist in the Windows world, and they probably should for the Linux and macOS world. Long story short, a lot of decisions to be made. And the choice was, let's make that publicly as a group and kind of take input from the community rather than just hammering the gavel and saying, this is the way it must be.
And again, that's very different from the Microsoft of 20 years ago. Before, they'd just be saying, no, we're going to do it this way and ram it down everybody's throats, and that would be the end of it.
What's the core value proposition here, though? I mean, Microsoft is trying to work with the community. They're trying to get this tool into the hands of non-Windows operating system admins. If I'm that person and I'm on Linux, let's say, and I'm proficient to that operating system, I've been using lots of tools that let me do all kinds of crazy scripting things. Even bash scripts can be incredibly powerful if you know how to operate the tooling. What is it that PowerShell is bringing to the table that gets me excited that I want to use it?
I mean, you're excited about bash. That tells me a story right there. But well, I'm being sarcastic. Yeah,
bash. I'm just making a point that, come on, there's already a lot of power there. So what does Power CLI do for me?
Bash is powerful, but it's same like kind of the jokes between VI users and Emacs users. It's like, yeah, this thing has a bajillion uses, but good luck learning all that stuff. And then you're going to have a very specific skill set that does not go beyond Emacs versus VI or Nano, whatever you choose. Really, the big one for me is it's object-oriented, right? And it's pipeable. We had a show on, we talked to Alan Renouf and some other people around Power CLI and PowerShell, and the big thing they all took away was anyone can learn this. It's a very simple language, but it's also very powerful. And because it's object-oriented, you're not having to kind of scrape across regex and do pattern matching and all this kind of stuff against text that comes back. You're actually able to take key value pairs, look at objects, introspect them, dive deeper, pass them along. And that, once you get that, once that makes sense, it is a powerful, powerful thing.
Now you're selling me. Now that makes sense. And really, to think of Power CLI and comparing it to a shell isn't, you know, in scripts that I could write in bash, isn't a valid comparison. Really, it's you're using this as opposed to maybe doing a Python script.
Yeah. Python, to me, is a little more powerful in some ways. It's got a lot more libraries. It's a lot more mature. But yeah, it's a similar idea. They're both object-oriented. They're both kind of a scripting framework turned into a code platform. And the other thing is that something that doesn't get brought up enough, there's a lot of vendors out there that have spent time creating code around PowerShell. VMware is a big one with Power CLI.
Yes, that's absolutely
a set of modules. Yeah, Melissa, tell us some more about Power CLI. I know you have to use it quite a bit.
I do, and I have to say one of the reasons I'm so excited about this is because I'm a Mac user. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's what I am.
Good. Very good.
Thank you. I mean, I can use Power CLI from my Mac now. I don't have to have a Windows VM running anymore. Because once vSphere went to the web client, now I can use, you know, vSphere client on my Mac. So from a pure administration standpoint, I'm excited for that as a Mac user who administers some sort of environment. And like you said, many vendors have this. So that can kind of be said for all those vendors out there. Maybe part of it is, you know, the people aspect of it, the kinder, gentler Microsoft reaching out to the Mac community, the Linux community, all these people who are administering the environments would have their own personal preferences. I think there's something to be said for that as well.
Well, it's funny you put it that way, because as a Mac user, and I have been for 3 or 4 years now, whereas prior to that, I was a heavy Windows user, there is a certain anti-Microsoft vibe that you get in the Mac community. Now, I'm not talking about sysadmins necessarily as much as just, you know, if you use this interface, you try to do as much as you can without Windows or without Microsoft apps, and because they tend to suck historically. That's not been a good fit. Yes, they run, but they're not wonderful things. Now you're giving me a reason as a Mac user and a sysadmin, if I've got PowerShell there, it gives me the opportunity to administrate systems that are Windows systems in my native environment, have it have a native feel, not have it feel like Microsoft shoves something on top of Mac OS and it looks so much like Windows, I want to shoot myself.
And I think we saw
that, dramatic.
You know, kind of leaving this world for a second. And if you think of Office 365, right, you can collaborate on documents between PCs and Macs without issues anymore. That's a really, really big deal.
Yeah, I think the challenge is that there's a lot of rework and rethinking involved. I know me particularly when I started writing code in PowerShell, never thought about it being ever run on a Linux environment or Mac environment. So I make a lot of assumptions like that there's going to be a My Documents folder and you know, a C:\drive, you know, that kind of stuff. And that, I think, lends a little bit back to your alpha question. There's a lot of interesting challenges to solve, both at the framework level, because we're really abstracting .NET Core and PowerShell Core, but also what are we going to do for people that have written code and are making those assumptions that it's on a Windows platform? So I think those are some challenges that need to be solved. But ultimately, being able to take code and write it in one place and then port it across other platforms is really the holy grail. That's why we're doing Kubernetes as an example. That's why we're looking at these cloud platforms, functions as a service, et cetera. So let's do that with our code as well.
Well, how portable will the code ultimately be? Because from what you're describing, Chris, some of the aliases that are used on Windows native PowerShell are conflicting with some other platforms that we're porting PowerShell to. Are we going to run into portability problems?
Absolutely. I mean, there's always going to be some challenges and outliers. For the most part, they just disabled those aliases in the alpha build of the open source PowerShell. So that removed the conflict. And realistically, you're never supposed to use an alias when you're writing code anyways. So that's just going to highlight bad code. But really what the framework needs to do is abstract things like environmental variables, looking for $home or something like that, where on Windows, that's going to lead you to the user's My Documents folder. Perhaps it's going to lead you to your user folder in a Linux environment or whatever Mac uses. Those are just things that need to be kind of taken care of under the covers. And then all the other conflicts, I think, are just going to be highlights of, okay, I need to figure out my code practices moving forward, because there's platform quirks with anything. You know, this is not really a specific thing to PowerShell and various operating systems it runs on. It could be Java or Go or whatever it is running on different platforms as well. So I think it's a good thing overall.
I think you should write a PowerShell script to take a PowerShell script and convert it from Windows PowerShell to Mac or Linux PowerShell. You know, change all those directories and all that stuff.
Will never happen, because I don't have a Mac and never, never will. I use the word
ouch,
never.
Burn. Burn.
I want to talk about Microsoft's motivation again here. They've open sourced this. Microsoft, I can't get over the skepticism that, just from a standpoint that Microsoft doesn't do anything altruistically. So is their motivation, kind of going back to the Microsoft and Docker conversation, is it about keeping people in the fold?
I don't get that vibe. You know, I get to meet with the PowerShell team a lot. And this is something I think they, as a collective group, that, you know, from the product manager all the way down, have wanted forever. It's something all the MVPs want. It's something basically everybody wanted this. And it felt like a little bit of a skunkworks thing where they said, can we do it? There was some work earlier on to make .NET kind of open source. And then that was made a reality. And like, okay, well, if that step is taken care of, can we do an alpha build of this on a GitHub environment saying it's not supported? And so it just feels like a bunch of nerds kind of saying, this is the world where open source software rules the world. What if we just kind of do it, ask for forgiveness later, and see what happens? So I'm sure there's some bean counter in there that's like, yeah, we can make some money on this or whatever. But realistically, it's just a lot of people who love PowerShell trying to see if they can share it with the world.
Well, it's interesting that PowerShell isn't a separate thing you buy. It's just included as a part of the Windows platform.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. You have Windows, you have PowerShell. Congratulations.
Yeah, and that's actually changing over time. You know, with the latest releases of Windows, it was embedded in there. Moving forward, it's going to be, the idea is to make everything a module and make it so that this is something you install kind of outside of the core Windows deployment, because otherwise they're coupled together. We want to decouple those. So you're absolutely right. It's kind of native to the environment. It's installed de facto, but it's not tethered to the Windows operating system like it used to be, which I think is a great thing.
Which makes sense if they're looking at trying to port it to other platforms, right?
Absolutely.
Well, as we move on from the PowerShell discussion, we're going to go to the big announcement, the one that had a lot of people going, what just happened? And that is Microsoft joining the Linux Foundation. So the Linux Foundation, if you've been following them, they have been absorbing lots and lots of different open source projects and bringing governance and structure to the development of those open source projects as they go. And now Microsoft is part of this organization, meaning they are part of the governance. They are helping to set direction for the projects that are going on within the scope of the Linux Foundation. Now, if you think about that for just a minute, that is like, because Microsoft and Linux were for many years very opposed to one another. The Linux community was very opposed to anything happening in the Microsoft world. And people in the Microsoft world were looking at Linux as competition and a target and, you know, something that they were very against. So the Linux Foundation isn't Linux itself exclusively. It's a lot of different open source projects. But to have them join, and not just join, they joined as a platinum member, top of the heap. They couldn't have joined at a more intimate level or at a higher level of commitment. They went all the way to the top. I mean, that's a $500,000 a year annual fee, which in Microsoft dollars isn't much, but I mean, $500,000 a year. They have influence on the board now. Every platinum member has a seat on the board, whereas by comparison, gold members have three seats jointly. In other words, every gold member becomes one big conglomerate, if you will, that represents three seats. And silver members, as a big conglomerate, only have one seat. So platinum members have a huge amount of influence on the board. This is a really significant commitment here. You know, Chris, I heard you chuckling. Do you have an impression on this?
Just two things. I mean, why did they join? They had 500,000 reasons to let them in. I mean, that's A. But B, wow, what an intelligent move. 500,000 is probably a rounding error of something. It's no big deal. To have the ability to finally put .NET kind of back into the mindshare, because it's not there. I like .NET, and .NET Core being released is a great thing. But realistically, they're not that juggernaut that they used to be, and be able to say, all right, for this small spend, we can have more influence in places where a lot of this code work's getting done. It's almost like a duh moment. They need to do this sort of stuff just to maintain some kind of relevance in there, and maybe about influencing the direction of .NET or influencing the direction that people are going when they're looking at writing code and developing software.
So I have a question up for you guys. Is this kinder, gentler, new age Microsoft, or is this classic keep your friends close but keep your enemies closer?
My opinion is this. I mean, previous Microsoft would have just never even thought of this because they were so busy wearing their blinders.
Were they just trying to buy the Linux Foundation, maybe?
I think it's a little bit of both. So they're finally acknowledging the Earth revolves around the sun, not the other way around, which is nice. And now they're looking for ways where it feels like there's a lot of internal changes that have to go to even make this relevant, and they're looking to make those. And it's a big juggernaut to try to move around. So I think it's a little bit of a both kind of answer. Although I don't know if I ever want to describe Microsoft as kinder or gentler, just a lot more business savvy and not putting their head up there, you know, and saying we're the world.
They're looking at some of their market disappear over the years, right? Because there are plenty of shops that operate in a Linux exclusive world, and they don't really leverage Microsoft technology. And when those companies are considering the technologies that they're going to use to build their platforms or to develop their apps, are they thinking about Microsoft tech? Probably not, because there's so many open source alternatives. Microsoft's just not part of their lingo, not part of the way they think, not part of the conversation. All of a sudden, Microsoft's there going, hey, guys, you kind of forgot about us. We really matter a lot, and we want to matter in the ways you want us to matter. So here we are. We're going to be involved with the Linux Foundation. And Chris, as you said, this does seem to be very much about .NET.
Yeah. Plus, it's kind of like at this point, I think, why are you not at the table? You know, everyone else is there. You know, there's a lot of big names at the platinum level that are sitting at the board level. You know, why is Microsoft, which, love them or hate them, it's a huge juggernaut in the tech world, making most of the operating systems that a lot of people use on a day-to-day basis. I'm not talking about coders, but just people. So yeah, you should be at the table. And it just makes sense, especially at that spend level. That's not a really big deal for them.
Exactly. And is it a way for them to gain some traction back in customers maybe they've lost partially or lost somewhat? Or if they have a customer saying, you know, we're really thinking we're going to go this Linux path, that's a conversation starter. And that's an opportunity to say for Microsoft to say, hey, we're involved with the Linux Foundation now. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about why you want to move to Linux. Maybe we can do some of those same things with Microsoft technologies. Look at our containers.
There's a lot of other companies that are platinum members. The rest of the list, it's pretty short, so I'm just going to read them off. You've got Cisco, Fujitsu, HPE, Huawei, IBM, Intel, Microsoft, who we've mentioned, NEC, Oracle, Qualcomm, and Samsung. For the most part, all heavy hitters in various areas, but all absolutely massive heavy hitters, commercial interests who have broad customer base and broad product offerings by and large. And so Microsoft fits right into that list.
Yeah. A lot of hardware there.
Yes, a lot of hardware.
I'm not really noticing any software shops. I mean, yeah, they all produce software, but you know, like Cisco, NEC, Qualcomm, Samsung, they make a lot of devices. So it seems like, okay, well, if we can come in and start influencing that, they're all like, nudge, nudge, elbowing each other like, yeah, let's go get a beer later and let's talk about what you're doing with the Linux Foundation.
Well, I think there's interest that these commercial folks have in what the Linux Foundation is producing. There is code that or software that can come out of the Linux Foundation that runs better or runs worse on their platforms or caters to their ultimate commercial use of these products. A lot of the Linux Foundation projects are turned into a commercial product. So at its core, it's this free open source offering, but that also means these companies can grab that code and use it in a commercial offering. So they do have interests in what the Linux Foundation is producing. On the networking side, oh, wow, we've seen the Linux Foundation absorb a lot of projects. And we're like, is this actually open source anymore? Because it's so heavily controlled by commercial interests. You're just seeing these projects, in a sense, they devolve into vendor bickering about what direction these projects are going to take. And whichever vendor has got the most clout wins, and then the project goes in that direction, that vendor with all that clout hammered, even though governance is supposed to protect that and and so on. It's not a bad thing necessarily. We still end up as an open source community of users with projects that we can leverage. But is this, in fact, still open source the way we used to think of it, which was grassroots and people contributing in their spare time and yeah, we're going to make this great thing and it's going to be free because everything in the world should be free. You know, that idealistic flag waving, burn the buildings down sort of an approach.
I mean, the Linux Foundation is also about ecosystem. You know, it's about what are people doing around developing, building the ecosystem, what companies are involved, what's the technology we're going to develop, both open source and commercial. And so it doesn't have to be like, oh, we're going to take over the world because we're on the board. It could just be there's a lot of projects and ecosystem, I guess, integrations that they can make or value add that they can bring, where if they're at the board level, there's just more opportunities to at least know what's coming, influence them,
exactly,
et cetera. It's not just like, oh, we now own the kernel or anything crazy like that. It's really just this is a community. And if you're not at the table, people are going to wonder why you're not. And B, you're leaving a lot of opportunities just behind.
I think that's a really good point. Now we're at the table. Now we have pull. Now we know the direction things are going to. We could take all this information, back to our organization and we can, maybe plan some special integrations on whatever side they may be because we have more pull. We know the direction things are going. This can also benefit the organizations in providing their own, commercially supported solutions.
Yeah.
Be there while the cake is being baked as opposed to, oh, the cake's out of the oven.
Exactly.
Good luck consuming that.
I know what's in that cake. I know a vanilla icing will go lovely with it.
Yeah, and there's a ton of projects in there. I was just looking up to see what's current today, but like Node.js is kind of under that umbrella. Open Daylight, OPNFV is in there. It's a big soup of a lot of really interesting open source initiatives that are being used by commercial initiatives or kind of open sourcey commercial initiatives, or just stuff that a commercial entity is standing behind to help push, like Cloud Foundry is an example. So it makes a lot of sense when you look at it, I think, from that perspective.
We've mentioned .NET as seemingly the chief aspect here, where putting .NET as a development platform and keeping that in front of people is key for Microsoft. But are there other aspects of what Microsoft's business models are that are going to come to play here? For example, they are a web scale provider. Does that help Microsoft being part of the Linux Foundation in some way, do we think?
I would think so. I know at one point I read an article about Microsoft. They have their Azure cloud switches, and they actually are based on a Linux derivative. It's not running Microsoft under the covers. They're running Linux in their own house at this point. So they've clearly seen the benefits. They're clearly joining the community. They're clearly trying to port that around the organization to different products. So I think that's really an interesting aspect of it.
Yeah, and I think, Ethan, you have to remember, I think it was like a year ago, Microsoft bought Xamarin as an example to say, that's a company that allows you to build for apps on any device, like different phones and things like that. So there's already an admission that they don't want to just be the Windows environment. They want to run on all the different operating systems platforms. It doesn't even have to be .NET necessarily. It could be Xamarin, could be PowerShell, could be whatever. But if they focus on just Windows as everything we're going to do is just running on that, that's a huge slice of the pie that they're missing because the software world is really where everyone wants to be. And if you're limiting to one of the 20 different choices for platform, then you're only going to get one out of 20 of the slices of the pie. So I think Xamarin was a good example of about a year ago when they said, yeah, we want to start investing in different platforms, not even specifically a .NET, to showcase that they're looking to be a big player in the software world.
Interesting. The common theme here I see across the three parts of the discussion we've had, where we talked about Docker and then PowerShell and now joining the Linux Foundation, is Microsoft trying to be very sure they are not counted out of the conversations. They are remaining relevant going forward with emerging infrastructures and making sure their existing technology is still getting love going forward. And they're not giving people reasons to not use them. They're giving people reasons to continue using them or maybe consider them if they haven't before. That's a Microsoft that I think is looking to their future and going, you know what, the way we've been doing it for three decades isn't going to work. We are never going to be the huge monopoly we once were. We are never going to retain customers and have a stranglehold on the market the way we once did back in the good old days when we were getting sued and stuff and the DOJ was investigating us. So now it's all about maintaining that relevance going forward, protecting long term their cash flow and their revenue, but from a modern perspective where they're doing it the way the millennials are doing it, right?
Well, there was a clear pivot point. I think you can look at 2014 when Nadella was appointed CEO. I believe in trickle-down leadership, you know, the way that the captain of the ship steers the boat, everyone kind of responds to that. And we saw a lot of changes, or at least initiatives announced after Ballmer stepped down or whatever that he did, and Satya was brought in. And I think it's just, you know, you have leadership that's kind of born in that era and looking to do the things that you're exactly describing. It takes a while for those things to happen. You know, it's been about 3 years since he took the reins, but I really think he's been doing a great job, at least from the third party, standing on the outside, looking inwards. All these initiatives that you talk about have really been very recent and since he took the reins.
Exactly. And if you look at kind of just the whole infrastructure software space right now, there's a startup for everything. There is so much choice for organizations when they're looking to pick that strategic direction. Microsoft wants to make sure they're relevant at the table. They want to make sure they're the best choice. And maybe if they can't swing being the best choice, can they still hook in to that somehow?
Well, guys, I think this brings us to the end of our DataNauts show for the day, this discussion of Microsoft and open source. So let's go around the table and find out where we can all be followed, because that sounds super creepy in an internet way. Hey, Melissa, how can people follow you?
You can follow me on Twitter at vmiss33. And you can find my blog at vmiss.net.
Yes, go read her blog. I discovered it and started reading, which is why Melissa was invited to be a DataNauts guest.
Oh, thank you.
Your blog is awesome. I'm sorry. I love it. It's not like I don't live in the world that you live in. And so when I read the articles, it's like, okay, I just learned a lot. And some of it's like so detailed, I can't, because I don't live in that world, I can't even absorb it all. I just don't have enough of a sponge to be able to take it all in. But it's so good and well thought out and applicable to practitioners. I mean, if you're looking for practical stuff in, particularly in the virtualization world, yes, go spend time at Melissa's blog. Very good stuff. vmiss.net. And Chris, where can people follow you?
The blog is wallnetwork.com, and I'm at Chris Wall on Twitter.
And I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks. Most of my blogging on the tech stuff is at packetpushers.net. You might also like my personal blog with other nerdy things at ethancbanks.com. And for more of our DataNauts shows, you can park your infrastructure engineering rocket in orbit around packetpushers.net. You will find the DataNauts chatting about containers and screaming about scripting, yammering about YAML, pontificating about PowerShell, conversing about cloud, and just kind of generally carrying on. Hey, when you pop a floor tile and look past the dust bunnies, there will be staring back at you. And until then, may your server lights blink, your stateful containers remain memorable, and your cables be cleanly managed.
Just like PowerShell is not posh.
What?
P-O-S-H. They abbreviate it to P-O-S-H. No. It is not a Spice Girl.
I was just thinking that.
I was thinking.